Welcome to the Water Cooler podcast, where we talk about some of the topics and issues that have been exercising our minds this week at the Menzies Research Centre. I'm Nick Cater, Executive Director, and with me is Fred Paul. Welcome, Fred.
G'day, mate.
Plastic seemed to cause a bit of a fuss this week when I wrote a column about it in the Australian.
It's a never-ending topic, is it? I think this goes back to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch from a few years ago. Back in 2015, The Guardian reported that there was this massive patch of floating plastic in the North Pacific, and it was so dense and so big that it could be seen from outer space. You'd think that in the 3 years since then that someone might have gone to the trouble of, you know, equipping a satellite that might have taken a photo of that and proven the fact. But
I think it proves the problem or illustrates the problem with this particular topic, in that it's based on the idea of marine pollution, right? We're not too worried about, you know, plastic littering the earth, although it'd be nice if it all ended up in the waste system. But it's the concern that people have, anxiety, almost moral panic about polluting the marine environment with plastic.
That's right. And you say it often enough, and it becomes a fact. And then the next thing you know, companies are banning straws, of all things, to try to alleviate this panic.
This is what got me to buy into it, Fred. I mean, I just thought this was quite eccentric. You know, I mean, you plastic bags. I mean, well, we can come to some evidence on that later. But I did think that straws was going a touch too far. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny amount of the plastic that's produced.
I think there's a good reason for this. And that is, it seems to emanate from the fact that environmentalists love to drink smoothies. And, and every time they order a smoothie, they have this pang of guilt about the straw that they're drinking it through. So, you know, naturally, straws became the issue that rose to the top of the plastic debate.
It's a good example of what you might call slacktivism. You know, the idea that people can take a stand for the planet without much pain or cost, just simply by retweeting something or something along those lines.
There's not a great sacrifice to most people in doing this, but the moral vanity they feel is disproportionately high, I think.
Yeah, and now we've got companies like Macca's and Hungry Jack's and even IKEA saying they're going to ban these things from their counters. Well, fair enough, that's not the end of the world. But you've now got governments too, or local governments, looking at it. Adelaide City Council's considered banning them in Adelaide, but they've discovered that they actually don't have the power to do that, which is rather pleasing, actually.
If all the people who supposedly oppose the use of plastic just voluntarily stopped using plastic, then our plastic consumption would go down. I don't know why whenever we identify a problem these days, the first thing we do is think, oh, what can the government do about it?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to first of all, examine what the problem is, or if there is a problem, and if there is a problem, is there a public policy solution which will actually cure that problem?
Well, precisely. I mean, it's been identified that most of the plastic flowing into the ocean does not come from the West.
No, indeed. A study in Science magazine 3 years ago showed that about 12 million tonnes of plastic, that was their estimate, is washed into the ocean. More than a quarter of that comes from China. And wait for a minute, the Australians' contribution to that is less than 0.08%. And of that contribution, another study I read looked at the collection of waste plastic from beaches. And again, it found that plastic bags were a very, very tiny proportion of that. You know, there are other forms of plastic much more common. And plastic straws, there were no figures on plastic straws, but you'd have to imagine that was even smaller still.
So, as a surfer, I can tell you I once had the misfortune of hooking on the nose of my surfboard a bit of plastic.
Shark?
No. No, a bit of plastic waste that was the result of previous amorous activities somewhere nearby on the beach. But I've never actually hooked an actual shopping plastic bag. So yeah, I can, as someone who regularly uses the ocean, I can testify to those facts.
So our verdict on this call for banning plastic straws is probably not a great policy idea. There's much more important things to focus on. Sugar tax, for instance. I mean, this neatly segues into the work that you and I have been doing on sugar tax.
Well, in my submission to the Senate inquiry, which one of us will be fronting in a couple of weeks, I pointed out that the sugar tax is, you know, it's a debate that doesn't seem to go away, and the response to it conventionally falls along traditional lines. you know, libertarians will oppose it and people who believe in big government will support it. But really, I think the most fundamental and rational reason to oppose a sugar tax is that it just simply does not work. It's been tried in more than 30 jurisdictions around the world, and not one academic study has been able to directly link the tax to a decrease in obesity anywhere.
Yeah, because I mean, there's some empirical challenges with this, aren't there? Because we're talking about a sugar tax not on every product, but just on one particular one, soft drinks. And then they've studied the consumption of those soft drinks in subsequent years after you've imposed the sugar tax. And what they generally find is that the figures are inconclusive, because they're looking at the amount of money. That's the most available figure, is the amount of money people spend on soft drinks, not the actual volume. So you could imagine, couldn't you? I mean, if they put the price up tomorrow, people would be buying cheaper own brands, or they might be buying larger bottles to get it in cheaper quantities.
Exactly. But also in Mexico, they've studied the actual take from the tax and found that the consumption has not gone down by that measure either. So the quantity has not decreased, and obesity in Mexico has not decreased. These taxes are empirically ineffective.
Yeah.
And they're aggressive. This is the main point that we are bringing up now, because the IEA in Britain has recently released a report saying that sin taxes are by their nature regressive. And that is that's the evidence here. The prototype for the sugar tax by all its advocates is the tobacco tax, which on the surface looks like it has reduced rates of smoking, although rates of smoking increased last year. But if you look deeper at the figures, you see that only 9% of the top quintile, socioeconomic quintile of Australians, smoke cigarettes. The bottom quintile, 20% smoke. So poor people are being punished by these across-the-board taxes that are not selective, they're aggressive, and, we can speculate about what motivates people to impose these taxes, and I think that's actually a pretty rich field of thought there.
You mentioned a very interesting statistic there, that cigarettes sales actually went up last year, and that's despite the ever-increasing taxes on them, and now, you know, various measures like these plain packaging, no advertising, etc., etc. I think the evidence that emerges from this is that up to a point, taxes reduce the amount of smoking. People are price sensitive. But when you get down to a certain level, probably about where we are now, it doesn't have any effect, because you're dealing with hardcore smokers, people who are desperately addicted to it, or for one reason or another. The mentally ill, for instance, would often self-medicate using nicotine substances. So we're at that point now where I don't think, if you could probably double or triple it, and all you do probably is take more food out of people's stomachs, because as you say, poor people smoke more, they'll have less money to spend on food for themselves.
Exactly. And the other consequence of that, the higher the tax, the more tempting it is to import illegal cigarettes. And that's not reducing the number of people smoking, but the illegal cigarettes are reducing the tax intake, which was, that's the ulterior motive.
So if you tax cigarettes, then people have more incentive to buy contraband, right? There's another source. Now, what about sugar? You see, that's the point, isn't it, with Coca-Cola. I mean, I don't have to drink Coca-Cola to satiate my sugar fix. I could go out and buy a Mars bar. I could do a million and one other things.
Exactly. And that's the flaw when people use the tobacco tax as the prototype for the sugar tax. It's apples and oranges. If people are looking for something sweet, some sort of sugar fix, then and can't afford a can of Coke, like you say, just buy a Mars bar.
And I think there's one more deeper question here when you go back to that first step. So what is the problem we're asking the government to solve here? I don't think we've really established clearly enough the public policy issue around obesity. Sure, we know obesity is probably bad for people. People more subject to heart attacks, probably more subject to type 2 diabetes and a few other things. But the cost of those diseases is not, I don't think, quite as high as the anti-obesity crowd claim. And once again, you know, it takes away from individual responsibility, doesn't it? I mean, is this what they call a public health issue or a personal health issue? You know, could it be something you ate, perhaps? You know?
And you're right. We need to identify exactly what the problem is. And it's quite well known that our consumption of sugar is actually decreasing while obesity is increasing. So we may well be targeting the wrong perpetrator here.
Yeah, and you're looking at one single cause. When we were saying that there's one single factor in obesity, and common sense tells you that's not the case. I mean, you wonder how much time people and kids spend on computer screens these days and less time perhaps being active outside. Could that be a factor? Well, intuitively you'd think yes. So by focusing on one factor here, sugar, you perhaps miss these other very important determinants. So another thing I've been having a look at this week are the Get Up and Greenpeace advertisements that are streaming on television. Very slick ads, I must say, very well produced.
So you've found that there's some sort of collusion between the two, is that right?
Well, they're certainly colluding, and they're open about it, that they're funding this campaign. Now, these ads are in opposition to the government's National Energy Guarantee Scheme, which, as you know, Josh Frydenberg, the energy minister, says we have to get through, has to go through with the agreement of every state and every territory in order to put in place their plan that will lower, reduce subsidies, or eliminate subsidies altogether, that's the hope, and then lower wholesale prices and then real resale prices. But Get Up and Greenpeace are opposed to this strongly, and they're trying to put pressure on state Labour governments to reject the deal with these advertisements. Now, I think that there's a clear conflict of interest here for Get Up, because Get Up has several brand licensing deals where it essentially lends its brand to various corporate interests to show that they're, I don't know, green or ethical or whatever.
Or just make their users feel better.
Them feel better, yeah. One in particular is with a company called PowerPoint, which is a subsidiary of Meridian, which is the majority New Zealand government-owned energy producer and retailer in New Zealand, which also has big stakes in wind and hydro in New Zealand and wind here. Now, that company benefits immediately and greatly from the subsidies that have been in the system up to now. You know, the subsidies in favour of renewable energy that effectively go in because of the renewable energy tax. That increases their profits. They're paying Greenpeace, they're paying Get Up some money, and Get Up are putting on these ads in support of policy that would support them financially. So it seems to me this is a clear conflict of interest. If this happened in any other sphere, then Greenpeace would be up in arms about it, and Get Up would, but they're not in this case. So there's a clear conflict of interest there. I think there's a conflict of interest too that Australia Bank, this so-called ethical bank based in Melbourne, that's another thing that Get Up has a deal with, that it pushes customers their way. And Australia Bank is involved in buying and selling renewable energy certificates. So they too benefit from this. None of this is declared, of course, by Get Up. They just consider themselves to be above the basics of having to make open and a declaration.
Don't you love these companies that declare themselves to be ethical?
Oh, indeed. I mean, what ethics? And they want everybody to disclose their vested interests, but their own vested interests are very opaque.
Very good point, yeah. The other side of this, though, is that we now have a new type of player in the electoral democratic process in Australia. I mean, until recently, it was Labor versus Liberal, and everyone knew where they stood. There was reasonable transparency about who supported who and so on. But with these groups that aren't actual players in the democratic outcome, that have an influence on the outcome, but they're not the actual players, there's all this new ambiguity, and that this has come to the attention of the committee that WA Senator Linda Reynolds is chairing into electoral issues in Australia. And before the Senate right now are some amendments to the Commonwealth Electoral Act to register these players, and to one of the key proposals is that donations from foreign citizens and foreign entities to political parties and their associated entities be banned. I mean, that would be a wonderful thing if we could achieve it. I mean, there's so many ambiguities in this field.
There are technical issues there, aren't there, with banning foreign donations. You've got to calibrate that correctly. I think I'd rather see some declarations so that people know what they're dealing with and let them decide. And for instance, with Get Up, I think almost all the policies that I see support either the Labour Party or the Green Party or both. So they're effectively campaigning arms for the Labour Party. So it seems to be quite reasonable they should be considered associated entities by the Australian Electoral Commission and have to make declarations. And I say that because we do. The Menzies Research Centre is an affiliated entity to the Liberal Party. The Chifley Research Centre is an affiliated entity to the Labour Party. We have to make those declarations. And I tell you what, it's not so irksome. You know,
so I mean, if GetUp wanted advice on how to do this, you'd be happy to?
I'd be very happy to advise them. And also to tell them that the people who give to us, our donors and supporters, are very relaxed about this. They're not worried.
They should be.
Yeah.
I mean, the political process needs to be transparent. It's one of the wonders of our system. I mean, speaking of which, the main beneficiary, as you just point out, of Greenpeace and GetUp's activities and so on, is the Labor Party. Now, Linda Reynolds, when she responded to this this reading in the Senate of these amendments, one of the first things she said was she thanked the Labor Party for the bipartisan support. Which is interesting. I mean, arguably, Labor would be worse affected by these amendments than the Liberal Party. But even then, all parties seem to agree that our democratic processes are far more important.
Yeah, and the other point I think that I think needs some reflection is the use of tax deductible charity status for political campaigns. Greenpeace spent last year more than $20 million. That's a lot of money, $20 million on what they say, what they call advocacy and campaigning. We call it propaganda. But that's $20 million that, if people give to the organisation, is tax deductible. So it's as if you gave to, you know, the Smith family or the Salvos. You know, you can deduct that tax. Now, is that what tax deductible funding should be about? And when you get a situation where Greenpeace are working on a project with GetUp, you know, where's the ability for Greenpeace effectively to transfer that tax deductible status through to GetUp, which don't have it? And therefore, you know, what this means is you and I are effectively subsidising their advocacy because they have tax deductible status. And I just don't think that's what that was intended for. It was intended for genuine charities that do genuine charitable work.
As Linda Reynolds says, this is a clear threat to our democratic process, and it's getting worse. You just said that they spent $20 million. I mean, where did that come from? $20 million, that's a lot of money.
Well, plain fact is we're not entirely sure where it comes from because they're not opaque with their reporting. But a lot of it seems to come from overseas. There's suggestions that large amounts might come from the Soros Foundation. Well, good on George Soros if he wants to invest in this sort of thing, but there shouldn't be tax deductibility for him. One other thing I've been looking at this week, and I don't want to go into too much detail because it's going to be the subject of a substantial report in the next month or so, but the amount of time we now spend on our phones checking the internet or Facebook or one of these data-based programs is huge. And it's in huge contrast to what the situation was 10 years ago when Labor decided to invest all that money, $43 billion, it's probably going to be more, into building a national broadband network so we could be wired up to the net. Back then, I was interested to see that only 7% of people accessed the web in any given month through their phone.
That's only
7%. But now, it is the most common way of accessing the internet by a long way, closely followed by, or followed somewhere distant by, tablet devices, which are generally also operate, on mobile broadband, not the fixed line broadband we spent all this money in. So we are using most people most of the time for most applications use their phone as their chosen device, which doesn't involve the national broadband network at all. So we've invested all this money, government money, our money, in a system which is subpar. We know that it's not even installed everywhere yet. In order to get people online, but guess what? The market has made another choice, and technology has enabled them to make that choice by bringing on much better devices.
A huge government infiltration into private enterprise. What could possibly have gone wrong?
I mean, people do use fixed line broadband. They might sit at home on a laptop or plugged into the Wi-Fi, or a computer plugged into the Wi-Fi. But they're using it for intensive, data-intensive things like gaming, like downloading video shows. And of course, in the corporate sphere, the banks, the big companies use it a lot. But I don't see why we should subsidize their broadband. They're big enough to pay for it themselves, when the rest of us, most of the time, for most applications, are quite happy to click away at the mobile phone. But anyway, that's a preview of what we'll be looking at, I think.
As we discovered this week, private enterprise is right behind the mobile network because our phones are much better at gathering data about us, because the phones follow us wherever we go, and they listen to us when we're even when we're not even talking into them, as you and I discovered this week.
Well, this is what we suspect, isn't it? When you what did you tell the story?
Well, we were thinking about moving our office. We were talking on the phone, discussing a prospective alternative locations for the MRC headquarters. And the next day, I was flicking through Instagram, of all things, and an ad popped up asking me if I was interested in renting a place in Surry Hills, which was the topic of our conversation that previous day. So I think the powers that be in the technology industry are right behind us, moving right across to mobile, because there's more money to be made there. And Kevin Rudd's NBN will be a museum piece if they can fit it into one.
Yeah, and some people think this is ominous or sinister in some way. I tend to take a different view. I think that, you know, it will work. It'll work commercially if it helps people. So if we find, you know, we are moving office, if we were to move office and we found that's meant less time Googling through, you know, 50 different pages in order to get to the company we want, well, then it's a good service. Exactly. A good service. But there are, of course, I think probably data and privacy issues which we need to be aware and consider. I wonder if they're bugging water cooler. Or perhaps we'll get all sorts of adverts for water coolers or something like that. Well, look, thank you, Fred. That's been a good discussion.
Pleasure, mate.
And we'll talk again next week.
Fantastic.
Bye.